Last time we talked, Bob, you were telling me some of the background for you getting into labor education was a scholarship you had to Ruskin College.
Yeah, I was one of the first five people, American trade unionists, to go over there.
Mm-hmm.
Babs was another one of the first five. She went from Kentucky. And three of them at that time were funded by the Transatlantic Foundation, which was headed up by a London banker, Sir Robert Mayer, who continued giving his three. And the other two were put up by the British TUC, and they dropped out of the program after a couple of years. But Mayer kept up his scholarships until sometime in the 70s, and I recall dropping him a note on his 100th birthday, which was a few years ago. I think he's since died, but he was a member, I think, of the Liberal Party. I'm not sure on that, but he put up the money because he thought exchanges were a good thing. Not because he was particularly interested in labor unions. And it was always his hope, and also the TUC's initially, that some American institution would reciprocate and it would be a two-way thing, which never materialized, partly because we never had a similar institution in this country.
Mm-hmm. What did you study there, and how long were you there?
Well, we were there for a year. I studied the British cooperative movement, the Labour Party, and workers' education. And at Ruskin, it was a tutorial kind of program where you wrote a paper a week in the particular subject you were studying, and then had a weekly tutorial for about an hour. Lionel Elvin, who at that time was the principal of Ruskin, was the person I did the political science Labor Party tutorial with. And he was the sharpest mind I've ever run into. It was like being in the electric chair for an hour, being grilled by him as to what you meant and why you meant it, etc., etc. I found him to be really a first-class mind, although his field was English literature. In addition, I got a number of opportunities to go to the continent. I went to several socialist youth conferences, and also spent, it was about 3 weeks in Czechoslovakia touring with the Oxford University basketball team. We were the first Oxford University basketball team. There were eight Americans, most of them Rhodes Scholars, and a Englishman born in Canada. And because we only had nine people, we couldn't have really any good practices. And most of the Englishmen didn't play basketball at that time, except maybe at some of the American air bases. We wound up playing for the British Championship against a team of all Mormon missionaries who were from the Brigham Young University, who were missionaries in England, and they beat us by 1 point. But in Czechoslovakia, we had an opportunity to tour the country. We started out in the capital, Prague, and went to Bratislava and all sorts of small towns in between. At the Sokol Halls, which was the Czech youth athletic organization. And fortunately, we took some basketballs along with us, because what they had were almost square rather than round. And it was an interesting opportunity to see the difference between the north and south, the industrialized north of Prague, mm-hmm. and the further south you got the more agricultural and the more backward it was.
What year was this?
This was in 48. I remember we went into the Russian consulate office in Bratislava, and we wanted to get a visa to go to Austria for a couple of days, and we had to go through the Russian-occupied part of Austria. And they asked us when we were leaving Czechoslovakia, and we told them, and they told us we would have a visa the day after. We were gone. That was the earliest they could clear it, so that was the... We never did get to Austria. We left Czechoslovakia about 3 days before the communists seized power. And it was obvious when we left Prague that something was going to happen. There were military on every street corner with guns, and something was in the wind. And some of the Czechs I met during this trip or at socialist youth conferences, the next time I saw more displaced persons camps in Western Germany after the takeover there.
Did you visit any other places where the AFL-CIO was already starting to be involved, and Victor Ruther?
Well, it was obvious that the AFL was heavily involved in Germany, and I think one has got to give a great deal of the credit to the AFL for the fact that Western Germany has a small communist movement. And I think they deserve the credit because they brought in thousands of care packages that went to trade unionists throughout Western Germany, which was the only thing that could keep them going. At the same time, the CIO was paralyzed because Murray never showed any interest in international affairs, and international affairs of the CIO was being set by CIO staffers who were communists, who took the position that the Soviet Union took at that time, that the only good German was a dead German, and therefore there was absolutely no CIO activity in Western Germany at all of help to trade unionists. It was only later on, after the break in the WFTU and the ousting of certain of these people and the coming in of Walter Ruther as president in 1953, that you began to get of the CIO, that you began to get CIO presence in Western Germany and in Germany.
What do you mean by credit?
Well,
was that a positive statement?
Yes, I think you have to give the AFL credit for revitalizing or even keeping alive a democratic trade union movement, because military government under General Clay, the American military government had no interest in trade unions. The French, and surprisingly the British too, also, because of their war experience with Germany, were not interested really in seeing Germany come back. And you had Henry Rutz, who was the AFL representative based in Germany. I know I contacted Jay Lovestone when I was over in Germany and gave them the names of trade unionists in Eastern Germany who needed help and who had smuggled to them food packages and other kinds of things during this interim period. And I think whatever the AFL may have done, whatever its motivation may have been, the results were very important for the development of a trade union movement. Later on, of course, the AFL tried to dominate this movement. It didn't succeed in Western Germany, certainly. But despite what it may have done since, mm-hmm. without this initial help, the German labor movement would have been in bad shape. When I was there in 47, and 40, again in 48, I took some of the young socialists to a restaurant, and we ate for a package of cigarettes because nobody wanted money. The German mark was so inflated. This was before currency reform. People were living in air raid shelters. I remember going down in several of them and visiting old couples who had no place to live, but in really wrecked air raid shelters. And the chaos and the economic disintegration at this time was inconceivable. I had a stripped down VW that was provided for me by American military government, and I helped move the SPD office in Hamburg in the VW because there was no other transportation available to them. I mean, we packed in files and chairs, if you can imagine that, into a VW, and got a lot of the stuff moved. So there was absolute chaos. In fact, when I think back, when I was there, I couldn't believe that Germany could rebuild. The working class area of Hamburg was in ruins. All you could see, for as far as you could see, was rubble. The only thing that was cleared were the streets. Now that was in contrast to Frankfurt, where the IG Farben headquarters, the chemical joint, was untouched, or in Wuppertal, where the harvester plant was untouched, and various other large corporations were untouched by bombs from any country.
Why? But,
well, I think it was deliberate. I don't think there was any doubt at all, but that our Air Force was given instructions to hit certain areas, and the areas we hit were largely civilian working class areas, and often the largest industrial complexes in the area were untouched.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think this was a deliberate part of policy of the American military at this time. The way if you could destroy civilian morale, it was good. And at the same time, you didn't destroy industrial complexes that American money might be invested in. And I think this was a classic example of the military-industrial complex at work in war as well as it operates in peace.
I just didn't know if you ever wrote about this or you've read about this theory elsewhere.
Well, I'm trying to remember. I wrote a piece for the public employee, the magazine of the State County Municipal Employees. I don't remember if I dealt with that or not. I remember it was the time of the Berlin blockade. I think I may have the article around someplace. But the fact that, you know, industrial complexes were untouched in many cases was written about in a number of publications. This is nothing new.
Just that you had seen it yourself.
Yeah.
While in Britain, what other examples did you see of the AFL or the CIO's involvement in the post-war labor movement?
Well, as I say, while I was there, the CIO had no involvement at all that I know of. The WFTU, of course, was not... well, it just been founded, and I never ran into it in Britain. In regard to the AFL, of course, the labor advisor at the American Embassy, a man by the name of Sam, oh, I can't recall his last name at the moment, was a former ILG'er who was a disciple of Jay Lovestone. who was very upset about the possibility of the left wing of the Labour Party taking over, and I think echoed the fears of the AFL, but I saw nothing directly about the AFL at that time.
Were there great debates among the five of you and other Labour people you were dealing with in Britain about how the Labour movement in Western Europe and in capitalist countries could be rebuilt? And
well, at Ruskin, all political tendencies were represented there. I remember maybe the second or third day we were there, some British student came walking down the hall and said to Babs, "I'm a member of the Communist Party, what party do you belong to?" And she was ready to go home. She was so shocked by this. There was a very strong communist minority at Ruskin. Most of the people were British Labour Party people. There were one or two Trotskyite followers. I can't remember what they call themselves at the moment in Britain, but the head of it was Jock Haston. And there were a lot of debates, and G.D.H. Cole, the prominent Oxford social historian or labor historian or political scientist, whatever you call him, plus a writer of mystery stories during his nervous breakdowns, was always torn between what relationships there ought to be with the Soviet Union. And I remember there was a large meeting at one of the Oxford colleges at the time of Czechoslovakia. And Cole got up and almost with tears streaming down his cheeks denounced the Soviet Union for this. And it was a terrible emotional time for him because he always vacillated between what he hoped the Soviet Union would be and what it turned out to be. And there were a number of discussions at Ruskin. I found myself pretty much with the left-wing Labour Party people who pretty much took the attitude that the Soviet Union was a reactionary, repressive force in the world, but that you simply had to try and deal with them, but you ought to do it with no illusions, simply because they were a powerful force in the world. And we had some of the Ruskin students who went over to Yugoslavia and helped build youth brigade that built the road from Zagreb to Belgrade. And I drove over that road in 73, and all I can say is, God help us if they had built more roads like that. And they came back talking about how everybody had smiles on their faces and how the new society had been built. And it was pretty much similar to what an earlier generation had to say about the Soviet Union. But Ruskin was full of discussion on these issues. There's never been anything like it in American university. Of course, this was a small group of only about 100 students. I don't know, there may have been one or two members of the Conservative Party there, but they were pretty quiet, being heavily outnumbered. best thing about Ruskin College was the tutorial program from an academic viewpoint, because each tutor had assigned to him five or six students who he met with weekly, and the student had to perform either individually or with another person from the point of being able to discuss his paper and defend it.
Let's take a break. What was BAMP studying? And then we'll move off Ruskin. Do you remember?
Well, she did this political science Labor Party quarter. And I really don't recall what she did the other two quarters there. I really don't recall.
No problem. After Ruskin, you went back to school for workers for a couple of years?
Well, I went on the staff, full time. I and another woman by the name of Gwen Goodrich, who is now Gwen Rappaport, were the first extension people that the School for Workers ever had. Prior to that time, the School for Workers only ran summer schools. And we were the first people to go on a year-round basis, teaching classes throughout the state of Wisconsin. And in the first class I ever taught in Wausau, Wisconsin, which would have been in the fall of 48, I came into the Union Hall. No, I think it was a vocational school. In Wisconsin has a vocational school set up that any school district can automatically get a vocational school set up by passing a 1 mil millage vote. I don't know if that's still in effect. It was at that time, and until quite recently I know it was in effect. Whether it still is, I don't know. The setup then with the School for Workers was that the vocational school would pay the School for Workers for the course, and the vocational school would offer it either free or a nominal $1 or $2 registration. Well, in this first class, there must have been 20, 25 students there, and in the back row there were about five people all sitting with suits and ties on. And I thought, there's got to be something funny about this situation, so I started out by asking people to introduce themselves. And when I got to the back row, one of the guys said, "Well, we're just visitors." Well, I said, "We'd like to know who you are. Anyhow, introduce yourself." So it turns out that one was a president of a foundry in Wausau. Another was a research director for the Marathon Power Company, the electric utility, and I forgot who the others were. Well, during the first session, which I was talking about labor history, I made some reference to the UAW having organized General Motors as a result of the sit-down. And at that time, Henry Ford said he'd never sign a union contract until hell froze over. And then I said, one day in 1941, hell froze over, and Henry Ford signed his first union contract with the union shop. And the people in the front of the room burst out laughing, looking at this one of these guys in the back of the room. He's red as a beet. And after the class, I asked one of the guys who I knew was a machinist. I said, "What the hell did you find so funny about that?" Well, he said, "You saw that son of a bitch back there? We just had a 6-week strike with him for union recognition. He said he'd never sign a union contract with us. And he finally signed one, so we were really laughing at him." Well, I also said in that class that I thought TVA was the example of a reasonably well-run, publicly owned electric utility, which was set up by the government because of the rapacious conduct of the private electric companies. So the letter went into the president of the university, "Dear Edwin Fred, from the Marathon Power guy, saying that he was very disturbed about the philosophy of this young instructor. And I think I'm sure I still have the correspondence here. And or how objectionable it all was, and the rest. Meanwhile, Gwen was teaching a course in Manitowoc at the Miro, let's see, what is that aluminum company? They put out pressure cookers, Miromatic, I think it is. And the personnel guy was in her class. Well, she was always much more, what's the right word, skillful with people of this type, and she managed to talk around him quite a bit. But he wrote in a letter protesting, these are the first classes ever offered. Well, shortly after that, a few months later, I had a class in Milwaukee with the brewery workers. And this was on the old University of Wisconsin Extension building. It was a long, narrow building, a not long, narrow room. Must have been 40 students in there, was Stewart's class. And I was talking about the reasons that wages were lower in the South than the North. And I said, one of the reasons is because of lack of unions. When I walked out of the class, I saw coming out of the back door of the room and walking towards me the attorney for the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association. Well, the next day I get a call from the head of the Extension Division, which was, he was chairman of the faculty committee, saying, what did you say in your class last night? I said, what do you mean? Well, I got a letter here from William Greedy. Greedy is the head of Greedy Foundries, G-R-E-D-E. He's also subsequently been on the John Birch Society Executive Board, in which he says you have made 7 subversive statements. And I said, what are they? I said, where'd he get his information from? I knew, of course, that it was, well, he didn't say. Well, I said, don't you think you ought to find out before you quiz me? Well, the important thing is, did you or didn't you say it? Well, I said, I don't think I'm going to respond until you tell me where you get the information from. Well, he said, we're going to have a meeting. So they set up a meeting of the Faculty Advisory Committee of the son of a bitch Perlman, Ed Witte, Adelson, who was chairman, and a guy by the name of Rundle, who was the dean of the law school, a Republican. And I've got this letter from Mr. Greedy. I asked Adelson for a copy, and he refused to give it to me. And I said, look, you don't give me a copy, I'm going over to the president's house, and I'm going to ring his bell and sit on his doorstep until I get a copy of the letter. Well, finally, he must have got a hold of the president, and they gave me a copy of it. And with it was a statement by Greedy saying, I forbid you from using this in any way. Of course, I completely ignored that part of it. But at the meeting, it was interesting. They finally concluded, well, maybe what I said could be true, but did I use good judgment in saying that in a city? Oh, I had also said that the Falk Company had robbed the government of hundreds of thousands of dollars on overcharges. And they said, how do you know that? Well, I said, I worked at the Falk Company. I got the records. I provided the records to the guy who wrote the book about it. And any time Falk wants to sue me or anybody else wants to sue me on it, they can do it. Well, but do you think it was wise to talk about that in a city where the plant exists? I said, I can't think of a better place to talk about it than in the city where the plant exists. Well, it went on for a couple hours, and finally Rundle said to me, or said to the committee, he said, I think You know, we're really talking about academic freedom. Academic freedom involves the right to be right, the right to be wrong, the right to be make a damn fool of yourself. He said, now, unless there's a charge that this person has deliberately falsified the facts, and as far as I can tell from the discussion, I'm not very familiar with this subject, I hear no charge of that, I think we ought to call this hearing to a halt. And they all blinked, and they all said they thought that was a good idea. Now, I had been promised a $300 raise, but I never got that. So I left shortly thereafter and went to the service committee. But it was a typical example of a university caving in under pressure from powerful, in this case, industrial interests in the state. And this went hand in hand with a previous action. About the same time, Selig Perlman, the labor historian, came to the office and said, told me to get rid of all the boxes containing pamphlets and teachers' outlines that had been stored. It just happened to be in my office because it was convenient. There were some top shelves there. And I asked him why, and he said, well, he heard there was going to be a legislative investigation. And I refused. I said I wouldn't do it. And he ordered me to do it again, and I told him I wouldn't do it. And he finally got Ernest Schwartzgraber to come in. He was a sick man then who was home, who told me to get rid of them. So I said I would, but I went through them all and I picked out all those I wanted. And I've still got three boxes of these pamphlets. The rest I threw away. Now one of those pamphlets, according to Harvard University, is the only one they know of in existence today. It's by, it was a leading anti-war female socialist during World War I. Her name eludes me at the moment. But, what?
Wapley Flynn?
Not Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. It'll come to me.
Yeah, don't worry.
And this was the climate at the time, in 49-50. This was before McCarthy really... Well, it was about parallel with his starting to open up. McCarthy was elected in 46 with the support of the CIO, which was state CIO, which was then controlled by the communists. And you had the climate building up and the pressure on the university too. In fact, I had a series of classes scheduled. One of them was on national health insurance. And I don't recall who it was that wrote in that this was socialism. And the whole series was canceled as a result of the pressure from this.
What was in those boxes?
Oh, well, in the boxes were communist pamphlets, socialist pamphlets, pacifist pamphlets, some workers' education outlines, developed by Art Calhoun, who was a Marxist professor at, I think, University of Kansas at the time. Material of this sort.
You have the stuff and will donate it to somebody?
Oh, I still have three boxes. Yeah, I've still been debating where to donate it to. I still haven't made up my mind yet. I was planning to give it to Wayne, but I don't like their access policy of restricting it to recognized scholars there, and I won't give it to them under that policy. I might give it to the Wisconsin Historical Society, which has a quite good collection and has taken very good care everything they have. It's very well cataloged and that kind of thing.
More of a left-wing MSU collection.
Well, the problem is...
Wisconsin specific?
No, these are mainly national kinds of things. I really don't know what's in there, and I want to find out sometime. It obviously isn't well known. And I would rather put it someplace where I think people are going to look at it and realize it.
Excuse me. What Perlman wanted to do with it, or who had told him?
Burn it. I think he thought this up on his own. See, Perlman was one of the two anti-Semitic Jews that I knew, that I've ever known. And Perlman was so terrified by Hitler and the Nazis that he didn't want anything done that could possibly turn the right wing on Jews or on institutions that he believed in. For example, when I was at the School for Workers in the summer of 46 or 47, we had a, I forgot what schools were there at the time, but we had one white student walking home from a bar with a black woman and three Air Force guys from Truax Field jumped him and beat him up. Truax Field was an Air Force base during, it's out right outside of me, that Madison was an Air Force base in World War II. We had a staff meeting the next day what to do about it. This guy claimed he could identify the three people. So I said, well, what we ought to be doing is going out there, seeing the commander, demand that he call the guys out, and this guy go look at them. Well, Perlman was hysterical. No, this will put the School for Workers in the news. It's an interracial thing. It'll raise all the hackles of the right wing against the school, and the pressure will be so great and all the rest. Well, ultimately, the school gave in, and there was no review.
What was his job or title then?
Perlman? Well, he was professor of economics, and also he was on the labor, on the faculty advisory committee, and he was...
That's School for Workers.
Yeah, and he was the most prominent and the most deferred to because he was the labor historian. Well, we had another example. We hired a guy this same summer for recreation, and he was very good. You know, he could sing, he could play the banjo, he could lead square dancing, and all this other stuff. And somehow, they found out that he had been a member of some, I can't recall if it was a CP or some CP-related group. So again, we got into the whole argument, what should we do about him? And I strongly argued we should do nothing. I mean, what the hell should we do anything? It's his business, what he wants to belong to. Well, again, Perlman raised this issue of, you know, what would it happen to the school if it was known that this communist or communist-associated person was with the school, and he was persuaded to leave the school. And there were a whole series of these kinds of incidences which really soured me on Perlman, I'll tell you. He was a great labor historian, but as a human being, I had nothing but contempt for him. Tell us the Dan Kruger, and he'll jump up and down and...
Did Dan know?
Oh, he loved the whole tree. He studied under him.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Oh, he loved Perlman. Yeah. In fact, he was there when I was with the School for Workers. I think he was getting his PhD then. Mm. I did not know Dan then, but...
Anna or Jack at that time?
If they were, I didn't know them. And the funniest thing was, you know, Perlman was considered to be a communist. I remember one time I was hitchhiking up to Madison, and some guy picked me up, and, you know, what courses are you taking? Well, I said, I'm taking a course in labor history from a guy by the name of Perlman. Oh, he said, that communist, you know, here this guy was so... I recall one student one time asked a question in class, a friend of mine, a very naive guy who didn't know communism from rheumatism, but it sounded like it was a question coming from a communist. Perlman jumped up and down over that kid for 10 minutes. When he got out of class, this kid said, what did I say? I just asked a question, you know. And Perlman just insulted him and said, you know, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Well, he didn't say hell, but you don't know what you're talking about. Let me put a little wood on the stove.
No, that's not.
I just announced him. Oh, it was terrible.
That was in 1950. You left and worked for American Friends Service Committee. All that, the most productive 5 years of your life. You want to tell me about that?
Yeah, I went there to work with a person by the name of Hugh Reichert, who had been a UAW member in Racine, whom I had known through the Socialist Party. Shortly after I got to Philadelphia to join him, he left to become a labor attaché. At the moment, I don't recall which country it was, but he from then on stayed in the Foreign Service. And I only saw him once since then. So that put me in charge of this Labor International Affairs Program. The primary responsibility was to work with the unions to try and interest them in international issues.
What was the title?
Labor International Affairs Program. I had a labor advisory committee consisting of Victor Reuther, from the CIO, Mike Ross from the CIO, George Guernsey from the CIO, Lou Hines from the AFL, John Connors from the AFL, and I don't remember the third AFL person. Most of my work was going to union schools, summer schools, in which I did a session, one or more sessions on international affairs, and also may have taught a grievance workshop, something like that, and also preparing materials for use by unions in the international field. For example, I did one pamphlet on let's see. What's it called? Well, I did one on China, one on Korea, one on Indochina, which was attempting to raise questions about American policy in those areas.
Mike who?
Mike Ross, who was the Director of International Affairs at the CIO. John Connors was Education Director of the AFL, and Lou Hines was, well, I guess at that time he was a special assistant to George Meany. He had been previously Secretary of Labor in the state of Pennsylvania. And, George Delaney was the other. He was George or Phil Delaney, I guess his, let's see, I forgot which was his first name and which was the name he used, but it was George and Phil. He was the AFL representative to the ILO.
And what was your feeling about your years with the American Friends Service Committee?
Well, I felt that I was doing some interesting work, exciting work, and also getting something accomplished, because there were certain education directors which would invite me in to say things that they couldn't say in their own position. And they were willing to distribute my material. I did a lot of discussion outlines on various international problems in addition to these three pamphlets, which were distributed. And probably most widely used was the flannel board I produced. Flannel board. I've got it here. It's flannel, and you stick pieces, you have flocking on the back of pieces, and you stick it up. And it was called Freedom from. Well, I don't know what the hell it was called. Well, anyhow, I trained these. I had a special training session where a number of the UAW education people came in. I think Carol Hutton bought 25 sets. How many of his staff actually used it? It was really what the underdeveloped countries are like economically and what the problems are. Ill-fed, ill-housed, ill-clothed. What some of the UN agencies were doing to deal with the problems, this kind of thing.
What could you say that they couldn't or wouldn't say?
Well, for example, that China ought to be recognized and admitted into the UN.
Why couldn't you say that?
Well, at the climate in the 50s, there were few public people in public positions who would be willing to say that because of the fact that this was not part of the prevailing mood of the time. I remember I went to a Massachusetts CIO school in the middle of Catholic country and talked about this, and man, they were outraged. I went to one of Fred Haler's schools at Penn State. It was the old gas, coke, and chemical workers. He came up and he said, come up and talk about communism. So I told him I thought a communist should be able to teach and do this and do that. And after the session, about six people came up to me, and one guy was so mad and he shook his fist under my nose. He said, you know, if we had you in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, we'd run you out of town. I said, why don't you do it here? Well, he said, we're at a university and we're not supposed to do things like that here. So after I got done, we showed Oxbow incident, and Fred Haler said, Jesus Christ, that's a lynching scene in there. They're at the lynchers. Well, Joe Joy, who was the education director then, was all upset. They didn't know if they wanted the school to go on after that session. So finally he decided, about 2 o'clock, he came to see us. Yeah, they would continue to school. And I was teaching another workshop. I forgot what it was, but it was, oh, one guy at this session jumped, I talked about lie detector tests. One guy got up and jumped up at the and said, I work for the Atomic Energy Commission, he said. I have to take my lie detector test next week. One of the questions they ask me is, are you a communist? Or, well, no, have you associated with any communists? He said, I don't know who you are. He said, I don't know if you're a communist or not. What am I going to say in that lie detector test? Well, I said, first of all, you got to decide if you want to take a lie detector test. Secondly, you got to decide for yourself whether you think I'm a communist or not. I said, I think I told you what I think about communism. I tried to tell you, although what I think about it, this is what I think the rights of communists are, despite what I happen to think about them. Well, the last day of school, this guy came up to me and he said, you know, after thinking about what you said, I'm not going to take that lie detector test. He said, I'm going to ask for a transfer to a non-sensitive job. Well, I don't know if he ever did or not. Another guy came up to me and he said, you know, I was so mad that first night. He said, but I've been thinking about it. He said, and I've had a lot of new thoughts about things I never thought about before. So it was really a very tension-filled week, but at Massachusetts, these goddamn Catholics, you know, when I said China should be admitted into the UN, the roof almost went off the place there.
Tension-filled weeks, but...
But I think personally very rewarding, because people started to think about some of the important issues and ideas that they had never been exposed to before.
Was this mainly or all summer schools?
Pardon?
Was it mainly or exclusively summer school education?
Mainly, but I came out to Michigan to quite a few programs here. In fact, I spoke at the first meeting ever held at Kellogg Center was a state CIO education conference. And I spoke at that conference.
It was the first Michigan CIO conference?
No, it was the first one ever held at Kellogg. And it happened to be a Michigan CIO one, but the first one that was ever held at Kellogg was a Michigan CIO one. And I spoke at that one. And I used to come back every summer at FDR. In fact, I stayed for maybe 3-4 years for all 6 weeks at FDR.
What was your first year FDR camp?
I think it was 51. And it was largely through Vic Ruther that I got in at UAW schools, because at that time he was education director.
And you and Vic were old friends by this point, or he was just on your committee?
Well, I met him through my committee. I had had some correspondence with him previously, but I had never met him before. Because I had corresponded with him about the U of M thing, which was taking place about the same time I was having trouble at Wisconsin. And I got to know Bill Kemsley, who was Don Stevens' predecessor, who was running FDR camp. If Sexton had been education director at that time, I would have never gotten in any UAW schools.
By U of M thing, you mean the GM?
Yeah.
UAW?
Yeah.
So you corresponded with Vic, and then he was on your committee, and then through that, you taught at FDR camp, UAW schools.
I was to all sorts of CIO schools. I went to a number of the chemical worker schools, and eventually wound up working for the chemical workers. Went to rubber worker schools. Went to the state CIO school, Massachusetts, Minnesota. I pretty well covered the country.
Any AFL?
Well, the chemical workers were AFL. I went to some AFT things in Minnesota. Trying to think what else. At this time, Lovestone was sending out letters a little later, saying to AFL unions not to work with me.
Why? Did you know?
I never saw the letters, but I was told by several people that they had received them, saying that whatever he was saying was contrary to AFL policy.
Lovestone was writing letters saying don't work with
Yeah, well, don't work with this program from the Service Committee.
American Friends Service Committee. Okay. And so they didn't.
Well, some didn't, some didn't.
You chemical know. Workers and AFT did.
I'm trying to think if there were others.
But in general, it wasn't, is the point. It was because of Lovestone's influence with meaning. And
partly because of Lovestone's influence, but also partly because, you know, how many AFL unions had education programs that amounted to much.
Okay. Brewery workers. Jimmy or George work for them?
Well, that was before George
and
Jimmy worked for him. Well, I was down at the Kentucky AFL school too, several times. But I think it was my. I also used to send out press releases to labor papers. It would be one Herb Alott cartoon together with 500 words of commentary on the subject of the cartoon. And Herblock agreed to make a special deal for me with his syndicate outfit. So I guess I only paid $5 or $15 for a cartoon, a very cheap price.
Along with 500 word
preemptions. Yeah. And various labor papers used to run it. Then I used to write some editorials for labor papers. I wrote several about the CIA, which apparently the CIA found out about. This kind of thing as well. But the thing I think...
And you're saying Lovestone picked up on that? Or?
I don't know if Lovestone did. I don't know. Probably, but I don't know. But I think the most useful thing I did was this flannel board, which was widely used.
The flannel board?
Yeah. I have it upstairs if you want to see it sometime. And then, of course, I got unions to use various films like Assignment Children, which is the Danny Kaye film about UNICEF. And I had some display boards made up, some pegboard display boards, with which I sold UNICEF cards. They were displays of yaws and penicillin-treated yaws and various stuff like that, which I used to at labor schools. Now, I left the service committee primarily because I read John Windmuller's book. I've got it in there, I don't remember the exact title. I think it's American Labor and International Affairs. And he convinced me, after reading that, that if merger went through of the AFL and CIO, there was no possibility of really continuing this program. And I think in hindsight I was right, that it would have been impossible with, although Mike Ross remained director of the International Affairs, Lovestone became the assistant director and eventually the director and was running the department for all practical purposes.
When Mueller's book, in terms of the AFL's role?
Well,
in international?
Well, it showed what the position of the AFL had been and what the position of the CIO had been. And it was obvious that the AFL was going to run the shop, and that the CIO really devoted very little time and effort to the whole international scene. So if you ever read the Executive Council's report of what has been done in the international field, it's very detailed, very systematic, and you understand what the theory is behind it. You look at the CIO Convention report on international affairs, it's a couple paragraphs.
Okay. Well, they didn't fund anybody to go over there.
No, that's right. They didn't fund anybody. They didn't have any of the experts. See, Lovestone, who's been the head of the American Communist Party, knew all the communists all over the world. And the people he hired were all Lovestoneites. Irving Brown, I guess the only exception probably, was Henry Rutz, who used to be a member of the Socialist Party in Milwaukee, where I knew him. But Dick Devereaux was a Lovestoneite. And let's see, who else was there of this old crew?
Is this prior to the Shankman story? Shankmanites and splits and stuff?
Well, see, Lovestone was the American head of the Communist Party in 1928, I think. He was the youngest head ever elected, 28.
Mm-hmm.
29, Stalin personally threw him out because of his policy of exceptionalism. He was really an American Tito. Well, from 29 to 39, Lovestone formed his Communist Party. Let's see, you call it opposition or majority, mm-hmm. I don't remember which. But he sought to recapture control of the Communist Party. And during this time, he had these guys associated with him in his own communist group. And after the Hitler-Stalin pact...
Are you saying Brown was a member?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Irving Brown was. Dick Devereaux was. Harry Goldberg was. These were all Lovestoneites, and they were all active on the... Dick Devereaux, who was one-time education director of the UAW, and then wound up as the Asian representative for the Free Trade Union Committee. And Goldberg was in Italy, Brown was in Europe at large, Henry Rutz, who never, as far as I know, was a Lovestoneite, was in Germany.
And what was, during these years, Bob Rivas was still a member of the Socialist Party.
Oh, yeah.
And what was their relationship with this Lovestone split during the 30s? And
well, they were, Lovestone tried to capture control of various unions. They almost took over the ILG, Sasha Zimmerman, and all of these people at Dubinsky expelled and ultimately brought back in were all Lovestoneites. And they were very, they supported Homer Martin, played a key role in the UAW. And Lester Washburn, who organized in Lansing here, was a Lovestoneite.
Right.
Frank Hinson, who was the education director of the UAW-AFL before it became the IW, was a Lovestoneite. So you had this crew trying to take over and making big inroads into the labor movement and various unions. Well, when Lovestone switched gears and became an anti-communist communist, a lot of these people then splintered off and just dropped out of his policy. But see, the AFL foreign policy was made by a handful of men. It was made by William Green, George Meany, David Dubinsky, and George Harrison from the railway clerks. And it was these guys had the, oh, and Matt Wall. God, old Matt Wall, what a son of a bitch. These guys all were opposed to communism for different reasons. Dubinsky, because of his own problem in his own union, where the communists almost destroyed it. Matt Wall, because he was against all isms. He didn't give a damn about communism, socialism, or anything. He was opposed to them all.
Catholicism.
Well,
you might have dealt with that, okay.
I remember I went to see Matt Wall one time with the guy I was working with, my boss at the service committee.
Who was that? Who was your boss?
Ray Newton.
Okay, sir.
We wanted to set up a program for international union presidents and secretary treasurers in international affairs. And we talked about having Brian McMahon there, who was the senator on atomic energy. We were going to have Madam Pandit there to talk about India. We were going to have William O. Douglas there. And I forgot who else. Well, we went in to see Matt Wall, and he was there with his goddamn little bow tie on. And we mentioned William O. Douglas. He said, I couldn't learn anything from William O. Douglas, and I don't know anybody else who could. And that told us right away where the AFL stood on our proposed program. But he was a reactionary son of a bitch. Well, these guys never had any discussion at any conventions. There is no record of Lovestone ever having spoken at an ILG convention, even. Dubinsky praises them at every convention. He's sitting on the platform. Did you go through the convention proceedings? There's no record of him ever having spoken. And this guy supplied them with the specific information to deal with their prejudices.
During these years, you're a member of the SP, and I was just trying to get a sense of how that related to these international questions, which are neither communist nor Lovestone.
Well, I think the SP's position basically was, one, you had to oppose communism, whether it be in the United States or other parts of the world, but that the opposition to communism had to be based primarily on political grounds rather than on military grounds. That is, the danger of communism was not the military threat. I think there was a general feeling that now a lot of revisionists historians have adopted, that the notion that the Soviet Union was going to overrun Europe after the post-war world, post-war World II period was nonsense. The Soviet Union, even if it had the intent, didn't have the capabilities. And that it was obvious that the Soviet Union would try and ring itself with buffer states, even though but at the same time one could not sit by and idly accept it if it could be prevented. But
could the prevent what?
Could prevent the Soviet Union from absorbing these buffer states.
So oppose the CP in the U.S. internationally, but opposition based on political and military grounds, but secondly, oppose
any absorption of these buffer states if you could. Realistically, this is a very difficult situation. But if you look at the hysteria this country has engaged in as a result of Castro, you know, this lousy little island off the coast of Florida, or Nicaragua, you can understand why the Soviet Union, for example, might be concerned about a fundamentalist Muslim group in Afghanistan and the potential that poses for its own Muslim population. So I think the SP, although it certainly felt that the Soviet Union was not a progressive force, that in fact it was a reactionary force, that you simply had to live with it. You didn't have any alternative. Now, this I think contrasts with the communist position, well, whatever the communist position is today, but at the end of the post-war period, the communist position was really, you know, support the Soviet Union at all costs, at least until Stalin died. The Lovestone position was, you know, we don't like Stalin, but basically, if you got a new gang in there, the system itself ain't so bad. It's just the guys that are running it that are bad. I think the Socialist Party's position was simply that this was really state capitalism rather than anything remotely representing socialism.
How does that differ from Trotsky's position?
Well, Trotsky's position was that it was basically a worker state and that the Stalinists had corrupted the worker state. And I don't think anybody in the Socialist Party felt that this was a worker state. That this was a state run by an elite, the Communist Party, which in many ways was worse than capitalists running a society.
Okay. Took you off on a diversion. Or maybe we should stop on the diversion. Unless the next story is kind of short, you went to ICWU.
From the fire, frying pan into the fire.
What'd you do at ICWU?
Well, I was the Assistant Director of Research and Education. I had been asked to go to the chemical workers for several years, and I always turned it down for several reasons. One, I was enjoying the job at the service committee, and two, the president of the union, a guy by the name of Bradley, was really a whittled down John L. Lewis. He ran the union with an iron hand. He was a racial bigot. In fact, in the 1954 convention held in Cleveland, Ohio, he ran in the union paper an official convention call, white delegates at one hotel, Negro delegates at another hotel, in Cleveland, Ohio, not in Austin, Texas, but Cleveland. So I was very reluctant to go when he was around. Well, he was hit by a stroke. The union was prepared to have a guy from Chicago take over executive board, a guy who I think was a pretty decent guy. This guy had a heart attack and dropped dead. He was in his 40s. And a guy by the name of Moffat, first vice president, became president. He looked kind of like Abraham Lincoln, and everybody thought he was a wise man because he didn't talk very much. The reason he didn't talk very much was he was too goddamn stupid to know anything. He's the father of the Moffat who has been the federal mediation conciliation head. Let me just check this part of here. Well, under Moffat, a lot of problems developed. First of all, you had the question of Johnny Dio being active in the New Jersey locals. Dio had a ICW charter, an AIW charter, and a Teamsters charter. And he was busy shaking down employers in Jersey saying, I represent your people if you give me this or that. We won't strike and all this sort of nonsense. There was a lot of discussion in the union what to do about Dio. And Moffat continually vacillated on it. Also, the racial issue came up, and merger came up, AFL-CIO. And Otto and I campaigned very hard for merger and to bring CIO people into the AFL schools and that kind of thing. At the 56th convention of the chemical workers in October in Buffalo, it was decided to run the Southern Vice President Mitchell against Moffat. Otto was very a strong supporter of Mitchell and wanted me to help, and I refused. I feel it's very important that union staff be non-political and not get involved in the hassles. And I remained neutral for several months. Then Moffat made a deal with the gangster locals for their support, and I threw my little support I had behind Mitchell, although I personally didn't care for him, and did what I could to defeat him. Well, Mitchell won by 30 votes, I think it was, out of several thousand in October. And Moffat was to leave office in January, his lame duck from October to January 1. Well, he first fired he announced he was going to fire 40 people responsible for his defeat. First, he fired a black organizer, Cornelius Maiden, for allegedly falsifying his expense accounts. Then he fired Otto, And he called me in after he fired Otto and said, I want you to be director of the program. I said, I won't be director, I wasn't hired. And I said, I don't think you have the authority to appoint anybody without the executive board. Well, he said, you know, you and I are different. He's from a different country. He's from a different religion. You know, he shouldn't have been there to begin with. So he had some words, and he announced I was fired.
When you turned down being the education director?
Yeah. So I started to pack up my stuff. About an hour later, I get a call to come down and see him to shoot. Him and Schaefer, who was Secretary Treasurer. And Moffitt said, well, we're going to lay you off. I said, how come you're going to lay me off? He had just said I was fired. Oh, I didn't mean it. Well, why are you laying me off? Well, lack of work. I said, you mean to say when you got two people instead of three, there's a lack of work? Yeah, you're laid off. So I went down and filed for unemployment insurance. And they contested it. Then the unemployment insurance began hounding me. Was I looking for work? And I told them, yeah, I'm writing letters. Well, why don't you visit the rubber companies? I said, they aren't hiring any education people. Well, what about personnel? I said, well, that would destroy me in my job. So we had this big hassle. So finally, they dropped their appeal, the union, so I got my unemployment insurance. So then they fired Marvin Friedman, who was the other assistant director. He did mainly research. Well, then there was such a hue and cry in the union. I got a call one more time at 2 o'clock in the morning from Tennessee, from the local union president saying, Bob, should we bring our guns down? I said, what are you talking about? Well, he said, if this is going to keep up, we're going to shoot the son of a bitch. I said, no, no, don't do anything until you hear from us. Well, he meant it. I'll tell you, these Southern guys were nuts. You know, they talk about unions in the South. These unions have had a tough time getting started, and when they once get going, nothing's going to put them out of business. Well, then there was a hearing, finally, on the firings in January. We thought we had the executive board by 6 to 5. It turned out that one of the guys double-crossed us. I think was paid off by Dio and his guys. At the hearing, I was given the charges. It was the first time why I was fired. The charges were insubordination, arrogance, insubordination, and false accusations against the union president. I called him a bigot, and I forgot what else. I said, they're only wrong on the charges are only wrong on the last account. So I called him as my witness before the executive board. And this poor dumb son of a bitch, I'll tell you, I had him so going. Now, one of the things he brings up against me is, we were for merger. I said, do you realize that the AFL-CIO and the CIO is merged? I said, why was it wrong to be against merger? Oh, he began to fumble. And after I went after him for about 40 minutes, they decided I couldn't question him anymore. So Otto and Marvin got reinstated, and I stayed fired, which I was glad it ever happened. I couldn't have gone back to that outfit. And that later on, Otto got fired again. And Marvin, I don't know if Marvin got fired or quit, but that was a mess. That was a mess. And this stupid bastard stayed as president. We had the merger discussion with the AFL, with the OCAW. We worked for 3 months. All we did was prepare stuff on merger. We had a document this big showing what plants we had, what plants they had, what plants were independent, what the prospects were. So they get to this merger convention, they wouldn't take any of the staff along. What do they start out by discussing? The differences between the two instead of the what the areas of green were. Well, they spent one day listing all the differences, and then they decided they were so great there was no point in continuing the discussion. They went home. There's never been any merger discussion since 56. And if you ever needed it, the chemical industry is one area. Well, we also had problems at the Southern School. I had out the NAACP pamphlet, Dial M for Murder. This was about Emmett Till, the black kid who was lynched after supposedly smiling at a white woman in a grocery store. And I put him on the literature table. Well, Moffat saw it, ordered me to take it off. I refused. He went to Otto and finally forced Otto to take him off. But this was the kind of atmosphere that this guy was promoting. Oh, he was just awful.
He doesn't relate to the District 50 Moffat.
No, not as far as I know. Now, maybe there is, but I don't know. He was just dumb. Just dumb.
Was he on the tape?
I think he was probably too dumb even. I don't know.
Let me call it quick.
God, what an asshole. Mm.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I'll try and dig up that correspondence with you. I think you'll find it interesting. Mm-hmm. See, it's somewhat similar to what happened when we were investigated by the Francis Committee here.
Uh-huh. You're talking about the pamphlets and that correspondence?
No, I'm talking now about, I didn't mention this to you, but the director of the school at that time, or the assistant director, agreed to send all of our outlines for review to this power company guy for his approval, who incidentally wound up being McCarthy's campaign manager in his re-election. Well, this is the same thing we did. We sent our notebooks up to Jack Breslin, took our notebooks up to Dow Chemical for Dow Chemical to review.
Oh, I didn't hear that story.
Yeah.
What year was that?
Oh, this would have been in about 59, I think.
Yeah. Oh, well.